All right. It is 1 o'clock, so in the interest of getting things moving on time, we'll get started here. My name is Emily Tepe. I'm the chair of the Intellectual Property Rights Professional Interest Group, and thank you for coming to our workshop. We're really excited about this. We're focusing on copyrights this time around, and I think you'll probably find a lot of things that you can apply in many areas of your work. Before we get started, please take a second and put your phone on silent, even if you know that it is already. Why don't you just check it one more time and make sure? That would be fantastic. This workshop, as all the sessions at the conference this year, is being recorded. And so we're hoping that this will be a very dynamic and interactive session. And so there's a microphone up here for questions. And I think what we'll do is pass that around so you don't have to get up, stand up and talk into the microphone. But you will need to speak into the microphone in order for your question to be heard on the recording. So please remember that. Our panelists today, we are missing one of our panelists, couldn't make it, but we do have two wonderful panelists with us today. Vicki Krohn is the Licensing and Procurement Librarian at the National Agricultural Library, and Hope O'Keefe is a Senior Associate General Counsel for the Library of Congress. So they will have a lot of really good information for us today. The way the workshop will go, we're going to spend about 30 minutes or so with Vicki and Hope giving us kind of a copyright 101 session, giving us some overviews of things that they work on, especially copyright law, publishing in the electronic age, and also fair use. And those will be things that we'll be talking about throughout the session. After that introductory period, we're going to spend about 45 minutes or so looking at some common scenarios that might be very similar to things that you have experienced in your own work. And so we'll do some overviews of those. We definitely encourage discussion in this section. So we'd like to hear of some of the issues that you've dealt with and how you have dealt with those. And then our panelists will also be guiding us through those scenarios as well. And then whatever remaining time we have at the end, we are going to play a little round of Stump the Panelists. So any questions that you might have on copyright issues, fair use and publishing or instruction or anything related to your research, feel free to ask those. We'll have time to dig into some of these topics, and I think it'll really help guide us in understanding copyrights and how to really apply best practices to our work. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce Hope O'Keefe, who will start us out on some Copyright 101.
All right, so I am, can you hear me back there in this massive room here? Okay. So I'm in the Office of General Counsel, so I supervise all of the legal issues relating to our collections. And that involves getting the stuff in, but the more interesting part of it is getting it out, making it accessible. And that involves a lot of time working with copyright, working with permissions, working with fair use, and frankly, working with some risk assessment. And so I'm going to touch a little bit on all of those. I think we're a small enough group that if you want to just raise your hand, and we can be a little bit more flexible and have a little bit less of the talking heads. I guess one question I have a little sense of how many of you are classroom educators? Extension folks? Okay. Any other big categories I've missed? And it will depend. Welcome. A little bit in the way that you use things and the way that your institution is going to analyze the risk of your using things. Basic first question, what is copyrightable? And this is language from the statute. It's got to be an original work of authorship. It's got to be fixed. That means it doesn't necessarily mean written down, but it can be digitally fixed. What isn't covered is grand gestures. Something, since this isn't, since my, I'm not being videotaped, then that is not fixed. And it has to be able to be perceived either by a human being or by a machine. So that's a pretty broad description. What isn't copyrightable? Ideas by themselves are not going to be copyrightable. What's copyrightable is the expression of those ideas, the way that they're described when they're fixed. And something of great annoyance to scientists is that something else that isn't copyrightable is facts. And that means that a lot of data is not going to be copyrightable. It may be protected by other forms of intellectual property that we're going to pretend don't exist for the moment. It may be protected, for example, by patents. It may be protected by trademarks in some instances. And something that Vicky is going to talk about later, a lot of times it may be protected by licenses. So the data that you acquire pursuant to license, it may not be copyrightable, but you still can't do whatever you please with it. So next slide. So in order to be copyrightable, it does not have to be registered at all. That law changed in 1976. All it has to be copyrightable, copyright applies automatically. Copyright attaches at the moment that it is fixed, at the moment that it's written down. And it doesn't have to be published either. So it doesn't have to be published, it doesn't have to be registered. Obviously, publication gives you a lot of protection, more protection, because it's easier to prove that it's yours. And registration, if you're in the unfortunate position of having to sue to protect your copyright, then it's very helpful to have registered it. One of the myths the United States Copyright Office is in the Library of Congress, so I have to do a little cheerleading for them. If you register your work, then you can sue to protect it if you have to. And that is a very, very important protection. It's also an important international protection. So what do you get once you fix something? What are your exclusive rights? Copyright is a form of property. It's intellectual property. So it's something that you own, and that only the copyright owner. And the copyright owner is not, as any of you who have published know, you're not necessarily the copyright owner just because you created something. You can sign it all over to your university if it ends up being a work for hire or your extension service, and you can certainly sign it over to a publisher. But once you own that copyright, then you have the exclusive right to make copies of it, to reproduce it. You have the exclusive right to what are called derivative works, to in the non-horticultural science example of that is you take a novel, you turn it into a screenplay. The screenplay is a derivative work. Or if you take a written data set and you turn it into, and it's a copyrightable data set, you turn it into an article, you turn your article into a book, each of those, The book is maybe a derivative work of the article. The published article is going to be a derivative work of your manuscript. You have the right to distribute those copies that you have made, so that once you make the copies, you are the only one who can send them out, or give others permission to send them out. Public performance may or not apply to what you do, but frankly, if you're getting up and you're putting your work to song, or creating or doing a presentation like this, it is your exclusive right to perform your work. And finally, if your sound recordings, if somehow you've created an audiobook of your article, then there are exclusive rights that apply to your sound recordings as well. And when we talk about exclusive rights, that's something that you can convey meaning that you can share it with someone, you can give someone else the right to do any of these things. Or you can say, you know, I want to work on this more. It's not ready to be published. And you can then keep anyone else from publishing it on your behalf. So the basic rules of how you use a copyrighted work. I think most of you, it sounds like most of you in the room are both copyright makers and copyright users. So the way that you use it, again, it is a property interest. It can be transferred like any other kind of property. Typically, it's going to be transferred in writing. But you don't, just because I own this piece of paper doesn't mean I have copyright in it. In fact, this particular piece of paper I have no copyright in because I'm a government employee. You own this. It's a U.S. government work. It's not subject to copyright. I have no rights in it. There are limitations and exceptions that apply to copyright. Those of you that teach know about the various exceptions that teachers are allowed. There are some special rules that apply to libraries and to archives that allow us to distribute things, to make copies of things, make copies of research, for example, in special ways. And there's a doctrine called fair use that, unfortunately, Krista is not here to talk about. So I'll be talking about that after Vicki finishes. The main thing that it's very important for you to take away from this is just that just because in this digital world it's easy to copyright, to copy something and to distribute it, doesn't mean that it's legal, doesn't mean that you should. And that's very, very true, particularly of digital works. And another factor to take into account, we were talking about this a little bit at lunch, so it's just because you can doesn't mean you should. And the other side of that is just because something is legal to copy doesn't mean it's necessarily the right thing to do. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we get into the case studies. I've created a decision tree. It's probably the most useful thing that you'll walk out of here. So you start out with the issue of whether or not what rights you already have in a copyright. Is this something that you created? Is this something you've appropriately licensed? Is it something that you have permission to use? So go ahead and use it. Second question is whether or not it's protected by copyright at all. Is it something, for example, that was published in the United States more than 95 years ago, so pre-1923? If it's not subject to copyright, then you can again go ahead and use it. A very complicated rules on duration, which you can look up if you need to. I'm trying to keep this short, but right now everything is copyrighted for the life of the author plus 70 years in the United States, and that's close to a standard in most of the world now. If something is protected by copyright, then you look at those limitations and exceptions. Is there fair use? And if not, then you look at whether or not you can get permission. And if you can't get permission, you look at whether or not you can use something else. There is a lot of stuff now being published either through open access or with permission, with broad rights, such as Creative Commons licenses. You can always find something like that. Or you can find something that's in the public domain. And finally, you look at whether or not your level of risk is acceptable in using something. And that's the very high level, how copyright works. And we can either, does anyone have any questions at this point, or? Yes. The cost of copyright is not, it's I'm afraid I don't know what it is right now. It's a lot cheaper than patenting. It's also much longer term than patenting because it's your life plus 70 years. The benefit of registration is really if you need to sue someone. But while there are proposals out there for small claims court, then right now it is incredibly expensive, and you would have to go to court most of the time. Like any other litigation, it's going to be resolved informally. If you can prove that you've registered something, then someone knows that you're serious, and they're more likely to agree to it. But because license fees are relatively low compared to what you can get, compared to the cost of litigation. One advantage of registration, if you do sue, is we have something called statutory damages. You don't have to prove what your damages are, and those add up pretty fast. It's a minimum of $35,000 for each act of violation of copyright violation. So that is a major advantage of registration if you have work of sufficiently high monetary value that you want to protect it. But the flip side of it is that you don't have to. There's a whole growing ecosystem out there right now of open science, open data. You can protect it through mechanisms like broad Creative Commons licensing, where you simply attach your which is legally enforceable, but where you're attaching, for example, a CC BY. You just require attribution, or you limit it to non-commercial uses. And there are multiple ways that you can protect your work short of registration by using licensing.
Another question?
I just want to make sure I'm clear. So you're telling me since the copyright law changed that anything you write down is copyrighted?
It's already copyrighted, but you can't. It's hard to enforce the copyright. You will have people tell you that if you mail something to yourself, you'll be able to prove that it's copyrightable. It's called a poor man's copyright. That is a myth. you can prove the argument was always you mail it to yourself and you have the postmarked envelope so that you show when you wrote it. That's completely unenforceable. Absolutely copyrightable.
All right. So another question and to follow up on that is someone wants to borrow a piece of your presentation. What do you do? Do you respond that, well, that's copyrighted?
That is one of our case studies. And the answer is, it is up to you. If you are the owner, the answer is you can make that decision. Just because it's copyrightable doesn't mean you can't give permission to use it. You can say yes, you can say no.
Well, I guess we might get into it, but is permission verbal permission or is that written permission?
If I'm getting permission, I'm going to want that permission in writing, but that's just legal paranoia. It's not a requirement.
And when we do cover this case study, I have a feeling that's a question that a lot of people in here have, and I know it's a question that comes up in my work all the time, so I'm hoping that we can definitely spend some more time on that a little bit later. Maybe we'll hear from Vicki now about publishing in the electronic age.
Okay, well, the first thing I want to stress in bold red letters is I am not a lawyer. I'm a librarian. I've spent most of my career reviewing proposed subscription agreements and licenses related to the materials at the National Agricultural Library. We are a national library and we're open to the public, yada, yada, but we also serve as the corporate library for USDA and all of the researchers there. So we definitely need to make sure, information may want to be free, but it's not. We have to honor and respect everybody's copyright and also ensure that our researchers are retaining the rights that they're entitled to. Yes, they're government workers, but there are still considerations of what they can or cannot do with information that they acquire in their research and information that they produce in their research. So my role here is to offer suggestions for good resources you can turn to based on some of the experiences I've had or been taught about. It's not legal advice. I will say that again. I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. These are some tips and things to consider. And I will provide a whole bunch of links to some resources that I find really useful. And again, they may change over time, so I didn't quote a whole lot from those sources. Each situation that comes up, you're going to need to do a little bit of thinking, a little bit of digging around, because this stuff is evolving. Just going from print to the electronic age, going from U.S. copyright to now it's global. Once it hits the internet, or if you're using a foreign publisher, all the laws aren't the same. So you need to consider those sorts of things. So in my role at USDA, I maintain the enterprise license agreements with dozens of publishers. An enterprise license means that the entire population of your defined entity, in this case USDA, the employees, the contractors, people who walk in to use the library, have certain rights that I have licensed from the copyright holder. And so the first thing I've got to figure out is who actually owns the copyright. Our USDA researchers may or may not have any copyrightable interest because we are government. However, they can sign away the government's rights to some publisher if they're not careful. So those are things I need to look for, because obviously we want our own research available, but if it's now owned by another publisher, then I have to license the rights back in order to use it. So when you're out there doing research, think about where your money's coming from. If it's coming from any federal sources, that can have some implications there. Who do you want to be able to use it? And along with the can you do it, should you do it, it's the yes, it may be a noble and good thing to do, but if you're violating somebody's copyright in doing it, it doesn't matter how noble your cause is. So you really need to think about can you, should you, legally, ethically, and what does your boss say? What does your legal counsel say? Because that gets back to risk assessment. You can do the handshake, yeah, sure, use my PowerPoint. That's a certain level of risk. You know, so you have to decide, is it worth it? Again, if somebody says, sure, use my slides, if you don't get it in writing that you were told you could use those slides, you know, how much is it worth? How much is the risk worth? The other thing, when you're looking at what do you want to do, from the library perspective, I license for all USDA employees and only USDA employees, and then I'm responsible for trying to figure out how to control that when we've got the general public wandering through. We also have some site licenses, which means that, well, and that depends, again, on your definition of site license in your agreement. Does that mean just the physical building you're in? Does that mean the campus that your building is on? Is it a geographic site? Is it a physical building? And the library looks for different aspects of an agreement that may or may not apply to an individual, such as the course packs for academic use, the right to interlibrary loan, especially for electronic. It used to be, okay, we buy a tangible book and we could loan it out to you and you give it back and we loan it to somebody else. Well, now if we have the digital copy of an article, thousands of people could borrow it and never pay for it. So again, that goes into some of the what rights do we have for redistribution, what has the copyright owner given us, and then what can you do with it if you come to us as a library. Post-cancellation access is a real biggie now that everything's electronic. You can subscribe, and then as soon as you stop paying your subscription fee, your right to access that goes away. I try to license it so that, okay, if I bought the 2018, all the issues of a journal, if I don't renew it in 2019, I can still access the electronic version of 2018. It's a whole different world when it's electronic, and with the push of a button, somebody can turn off your access or delete the whole file. So when I'm looking at what are my rights, what do I want to license, or what do the publishers or the copyright owner actually have, there are a couple of good glossaries that I have put up here to try and translate some of this stuff, because for each license from each publisher, they might have a little bit different definition. And you want to make sure you understand what you're agreeing to or what you're signing away on, even just to have a good conversation with your legal counsel or your copyright specialist in your organization. It helps to have the cheat sheet of the glossary to know exactly what they're talking about. Again, there's just an example here of the LibLicense is a discussion group that I participate in. They have a vocabulary. They also have some sample licenses and some things to look for or watch out for. Again, the URL is there. You can browse through that. And I would recommend that whenever you come into one of your personal situations, flip through some of these resources just to see if it triggers anything in your mind, a question you might want to ask or something you hadn't thought about. And those sites will change as laws change, as precedents are set, as people get burned on things. When it comes to scientific research, especially if it is done by or funded by taxpayer money or a government institution, we're trying to capture that and make sure that the taxpayer gets as much access as possible. And there's a little bit of give and take because a lot of the publishing has been done by commercial entities. And we need to respect that and understand that, you know, their distribution channels, especially in the past or now electronically, we depend on that to get this information out. But there's a cost involved, and we don't want to run them out of business just because, you know, we think our information should be free. So we are participating in science.gov, which is where you can find an awful lot of U.S. government science information. Not all, but we're trying. It's free access to R&D results across 13 federal agencies. It is an online resource, so definitely stop there and see how that fits in with what are they doing, and you know, is there advice or warnings there or examples you might want to follow. I'm not going to read the whole slide to you, but you can see all the different agencies that are involved in science.gov. WorldwideScience.org is beyond federal. It's global. The Office of Scientific and Technical Information in the Department of Energy has pulled that together. Again, trying to make information as available as possible worldwide, given that you know, we have language and legal and geographic issues. We want scientific information to be as readily accessible as possible. So again, using those sites, you can find out what's already out there and easily usable versus you know, what things may or may not be. I've posted here the basic text from the 2013 OSTP memorandum that basically said, hey, if taxpayers are paying for this research, it has to be made available, free public access, to the extent feasible and permitted by law, which is where it comes back around to we've got to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater to give away rights that we already had because it was government funded. Counterbalancing that again with we work hand in hand with publishers to make sure that it's formatted in the right way and distributed in the right way. So those are things to consider both as a user of something that might be copyrighted, but also if you are generating something that could be copyrighted, pay attention to how do you want this to be able to be used, or how does your agency employer expect it to be used, and make sure you're not closing any doors that you want to leave open. A resource that we find really helpful in the library, it's hard to keep track of who owns copyright. There is an agency, the Copyright Clearance Center. It's voluntary, but when we are copying in the library and it's not very, you know, clearly obvious that we're paying, hitting a paywall and paying for the article outright and what we can do with it, we can go to the Copyright Clearance Center and find out and pay through their service a fee, which gives us the right to whatever it's specified that we're doing with it. And in our case, it's usually providing a copy to somebody else.
And if I can interrupt, your university almost definitely works with the Copyright Clearance Center.
And so that's a relatively quick and easy way to keep honest. Creative Commons, we mentioned that earlier too. That's a nonprofit organization came up with this idea, and it's trying to simplify keeping some reasonable rights for the creator or the owner, I guess, of intellectual property without getting it bogged down in legalese. Whitehouse.gov actually uses a Creative Commons license on their website if you want to see how that works. And it basically comes down to, depending on the level of Creative Commons license you want to use, it's, you know, be fair, give us credit, you can use this stuff all you want, but just tell somebody where you got it from and don't, you know, mess around with it and change it and then claim you got it from Whitehouse.gov or whoever. International copyright. There is no such thing. There is no one international law for copyright. It's sort of evolving, but like anything else, each country has their history and their culture and their perspective on information and commerce and rights and penalties and that sort of thing. So if you're going to copyright something, know where it's being copyrighted, know where it's being published, and you know how a given country might perceive that. If you're vacationing and you write your autobiography, it might be different than if you're sitting in your office here in the good old US of A. Are you writing it on a napkin? Are you writing it digitally? Different rules apply. So you definitely want to check out where and how the laws apply in your particular situation. Just a brief mention of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Again, there's a big difference in how things were looked at when we were all print and as things have evolved into the digital world, electronic music, that sort of thing. And it's based partly on electronic commerce, but again, you have to consider international aspects of intellectual property. It's not just what you think it should be or what you've been used to it being in your hometown. And again, the links are there for you to review the text as it was written, but then you, again, want to keep up with how is this being applied? How is it evolving? I mean, that was brand new and a big deal in 1998, but that was a long time ago now. With that, I guess I will toss it back to you.
Yeah. Thank you, Vicki. We will be posting, just so you know, we will be posting this presentation online, so you'll have access to these links if you weren't able to get them all written down. We'll talk a few minutes quickly about fair use, get an overview of that, and then we'll go into some of these case studies where we can talk about some practical applications of these concepts. So, Hope, would you like to talk a little bit about fair use?
Yes. Well, I am not Krista Cox, sadly, because Krista is brilliant. She works for the Association of Research Libraries. Probably many of your universities are affiliated with ARL. It's a wonderful organization. One of the things that they have done is a lot of work in developing best practices for fair use. And if I were as organized as Vicki, I would have given you links. But if you Google fair use best practices, you'll be able to access them. And I would particularly point you to the one for research libraries and the one for orphan works. So fair use is the big exception. It's one of the limitations and exceptions, in addition to the library rights, educator rights, to the requirement that you get permission before you use something. The statute says that it's for purposes such as, so they're simply examples, it's not an exclusive list, criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research, i.e. a lot of what you guys do. However, just because it's for teaching and scholarship doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be fair use, as any textbook publisher is going to tell you. If there are people that are out there making their living writing textbooks, they don't necessarily want you to be able to grab them and run them through your scanner and give them to your students. So the determination of fair use, the idea of fair use is that it's a loophole. It's an escape valve that the Supreme Court has described as rooted in the First Amendment. It's rooted in free speech, and as a result, it's a balancing test. So it's a balance of four factors. The first factor is the nature of the use. Is it non-commercial? Is it transformative? Is it something that's different from the use that something was originally created for? So that if I create a newspaper archive, and Library of Congress has huge newspaper archives, newspapers were originally designed to give you news of the day, and tomorrow it's good for wrapping your fish and lining your birdcage. But if I take it 10 years later, it's used for a completely transformative purpose. Scanning books, the Google Books project, that's another example where it was making printed books accessible to the blind. Court held that was a fair use. It's the right thing to do, making things more accessible that were completely inaccessible, but not a transformative use. Books were written to be read, and what you're doing is making it possible for people with visual disabilities to read it. So that's not transformative. It's precisely the same use. But if you're taking it and you're allowing people to, as Google did, create a digital index, so that you can look up references that aren't in the physical index, because Google is going to allow you to do a keyword search on the roughly 17 million volumes that they now have and that HathiTrust now has, then that is a transformative use. It's something that you were not able to do when it was a paper book. Courts are currently saying that's the most important of the four factors, whether or not something is transformative. The second issue, which relates quite a bit probably to the folks in this room, is the nature of the copyrighted work. Is it published or unpublished? If it's unpublished, it's a little bit less likely to be fair use. But the more important factor, the more important question of the nature of the work is this something that's highly creative, or is this something that's purely factual? The further it is on that fact continuum makes it more likely that the use is going to be a fair use. And again, no one of these factors is dispositive, but these are the things that a court will look at and that you will look at in determining whether or not you have a good defense in your work. The third factor is the amount of the work that you're using. So this is where we talk about copyright myths. Oh, if I use fewer than 30 seconds of a sound recording, or if I use no more than one chapter, or no more than X number of words, then it's safe, it's going to be fair use. That's not particularly helpful, and it's not necessarily true. There are some guidelines out there, but there's also a very big lawsuit out there being brought against Georgia State by the Copyright Clearance Center, and are funded by the Copyright Clearance Center and being brought by some academic publishers. Because, again, academic publishing is an industry, and they don't want their primary audience or their primary market, which is universities, just up and taking it. The fourth, at the same time, what courts are now saying is that you should not be using more than you need to use to accomplish your purpose. If Google is scanning all of the books so that you can index them, you have to scan the whole thing in order to accomplish that purpose. And that, as a result, in the Google Books case, it was found to be fair use. At the same time, if what you're taking is a small portion of the work, but it goes to the heart of the matter, that has been held not to be fair use. The main Supreme Court case on that involved President Ford's autobiography. And a magazine took a really short part of Ford's autobiography, his discussion of his pardon of President Nixon, which just happened to be the only reason why anybody would buy the autobiography. And the Supreme Court held that taking that really went to the heart of it and therefore was not fair use. And the fourth fair use factor is the effect on the market. And some cases have now been holding that the question is also, is it licensable? Fair use is very, very squishy. The fifth factor that they say is you don't know that it's fair use until you've gone to a judge and it's been appealed and then the Supreme Court has ruled on it or denied cert, all of which is very expensive. So people will try to scare you away from fair use. There's always an element of, as Vicki mentioned, risk assessment attached when you're arguing fair use. And that's where the best practices that the Association of Research Libraries and other institutions have pulled together are very helpful. I can tell my kids, well, just because the other kids do it that way doesn't mean that it's okay. But it's a pretty useful defense to say that, in fact, this is the way that it works, that it works in the real world. And I have very successfully used those principles to defend uses without permission. But fair use is a very useful tool. And I want to talk a little bit about that risk assessment. It's very expensive to get permission, and sometimes it's impossible to get permission. There's an issue of orphan works. An orphan work is when you may not know who wrote it or who created it because it's a photograph without a label on it, or you may be unable to locate it even though you think that it's in copyright, and that's a situation where very often people are able to rely on fair use. But risk assessment, the question, there's a saying out there that everybody should violate copyright, but they should do it knowingly. That you need to be aware of what you're doing, who is going to care. And you don't always know who is going to care. But to be very, very aware and to create that balance for yourself of whether or not it's appropriate within your institution's guidelines and your personal guidelines as to whether or not this is something that you can or should use without permission. And it can be a very tough call, and that's where developing best practices and working with your counsel or working with your other folks in the faculty can be very helpful.
Great, thank you. All right, let's open things up to a little bit of discussion. We'll take one question before we get started on some of these case studies. Sure.
Yeah.
Your comments on fair use made me go immediately to thoughts of interlibrary loans and the issues that we're experiencing as a society where one library will buy this journal, another will buy that journal, and then they equally share back and forth the materials. Essentially, you're affecting the market there.
Very much so.
So how do we put a stop to that?
That comes under another doctrine, which is there's another exception called Section 108, which is the one that applies specifically to libraries and archives. There were guidelines that developed a very long time ago for interlibrary loan, which is specifically that interlibrary loan cannot be used as a substitute for a subscription. So there are guidelines that libraries have been applying for damn close to 40 years now about the number of times that you can borrow a particular book or a particular article before you're required to buy a copy. And at that point, you're not supposed to be able to borrow it anymore.
I was thinking more about the number of times that they borrow a Hort Science article and don't have the subscription anymore.
Well, that's precisely the point.
Not just the same article, but would be different articles from the same journal.
And that's why, and I'll let Vicky talk to. That's why libraries are spending more and more money on subscriptions. Because as the subscription base contracts, because it's easier to make copies of things, then the costs are just really becoming astronomical, and you do end up looking at some of the alternatives to journals, so that you look at I'm sorry, I don't know what the agricultural version of PubMed is, which is what Andrew, pardon?
PubAg,
okay. but you do start looking at the open access stuff out there, but absolutely it's a real problem, and it goes into that fourth factor. And I mentioned the Georgia State case. That is why Georgia State has been sued by the publishers, because they were putting things into their course packs beyond the what are called these CON2 guidelines. And the argument of the publishers was that it was not fair use, and that they had to subscribe.
And that's also, too, where the Copyright Clearance Center comes in. If we don't have a subscription to something, we track how many times we borrow from that journal. And when it hits the threshold, and I think the last time, I'm not in interlibrary loan anymore, it was five articles.
Five articles.
Yeah. Is this still five? Yeah. Then we were paying. We would go to Copyright Clearance, and we would register each time then that we loaned that particular thing out, because we don't have any desire to run publishers out of business. The more the merrier. There are financial constraints. There are, you know, what is reasonable to me might not be reasonable to you, but there are all kinds of checks and balances. And again, it gets back to risk assessment. Do we want to gouge the publishers? Because it turns around, then the subscription rates are going to go up. So we don't really end up gaining anything by doing that. So, again, it's finding a balance and doing what is reasonable, legal, ethical, and works as a win-win for everybody as best we can.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. The first scenario that we have to look at is related to open access. And I think what we'll do is we have six of these to go over, and there's definitely some overlap among them, but I think we'll try to tailor these to who's here. And so if you have any specific questions about each of these, we'll definitely spend time on them. If there are some scenarios that we look at that maybe no one is really concerned with, we can pass over them. But open access has certainly become a bigger issue, and there are plenty of government grant programs that now require open access as part of the grant. And I'm wondering if anyone has any specific questions that they've come across in this kind of situation.
Well, I have a question. What do you mean by open access? Because open access is not necessarily open access. There are different levels. People use that phrase differently. Some people call government published information open access. Technically, that's a stretch of that particular phrase, the way most publishers use it. Publishers who publish open access charge the author a fee rather than the library or the subscriber. Somebody is handing money over. And again, it can depend on the particular deal that was cut with that particular publication. There is no one answer for once it's granted who owns it. It depends. You've got to read whatever open access agreement you're trying to sign and think about your long-range goal. The Ag Library has turned down paying for open access to our publishers. We still go with subscriptions. Some of the USDA researchers and USDA itself are paying open access fees. But as a library, we've stuck with the subscription model because, again, open access can mean a lot of different things, and that's not something that we have the expertise to manage all the different definitions and permutations. So, again, how does it affect subsequent publication, and what if my publisher wants exclusive rights? Well, depends on who had the original rights and what they signed off and what they kept. So you really need to do your research in your particular situation. There is no one answer for that one.
It's also it's a growing trend in universities. I don't know if it's true of any of your universities. In addition to the grant requirement that you deposit a copy of your research and articles resulting from grant research, very often you've now got universities requiring that deposit with the university of work that you've done. But again, there are all kinds of limitations on what access is, and to some degree you're signing it away when you sign for publication.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on that particular topic? Yes.
And it's all funded by USDA. A colleague approached me to borrow the data, part of the data, for students to do practice on a certain computer software. And then they ended up wanting to publish an article. So I requested them, you have to acknowledge my name and my coworkers, my colleagues, that put the effort together to acquire this original data to start with. What's the issue here? I mean, they want to use a part of the data to do their own work. I granted their permission. I said, this is public information, it's fine. But they want to publish their article without including us, because they believe that they are right to use the analysis part that was not in our original research scenario. So what's your recommendation? Now, this is a make-it-believe, all right? It's just make-it-believe. But I think that some people run into similar issues when your colleagues or grad students asking for a part of the data to do something else.
Yeah, that is, that is literally case study number two. Has she put it up yet? Yeah, there it is. Okay. And this goes back to the question of what is legal versus what is right, and what is the best practice, what is the best professional practice. But if you're doing that analysis, if you're the one who wants to reuse the data, you start by looking at what rights are attached to the data. You look at whether it's open public data, such as you've just described, so that there would be fewer legal restrictions on it. You look at whether it's a government work. You also would have to look at whether this data is a licensed database, which is going to put controls on it and contractual limitations on it that are wholly separate from whatever copyright limitations might be. So you have to look at how you got this data. If you're doing a copyright analysis, you want to look at the nature of the data. Is it just pure numbers? Is it just pure biological facts versus something that's creative expression? Because as we started out, we're saying pure facts, pure data is not going to be copyrightable. Great case just came down this week. Someone complained. This was in the EU that. Somebody that another company had copied the taste of their cheese. And the ruling, even in the EU, which protects data and has stronger rights than we have here in the United States, was no, the taste of cheese is not copyrightable. Perhaps it's patentable, perhaps it's trademarkable, certainly the name of the cheese is, but it's something that is not subject to copyright. then the next thing you want to look at is how you're using the data. Are you just using it are you republishing it? We talked I think before about taking the same table and just republishing precisely the same table unchanged without different analysis. That's going to be more problematic than if, as in your maybe hypothetical, if you're taking the same data, interpreting it, analyzing it in a different way. That is more likely to be something that looks like a fair use. You want to look at whether or not your use of it is transformational. Are you using precisely the same data, trying to reproduce the same results? Or are you just plagiarizing? There's a difference between copyright and plagiarism. Something may not be a violation of copyright, but may still be a violation of academic proprieties. And then you start looking at what the best practice is in the field. I would assume that the best practice is always going to be basic courtesy and attribution. That's not a legal requirement. It's just the right thing to do. Can you sue them for not giving you attribution? Perhaps not, unless you've attached a Creative Commons license to something. Can you trash them to everyone you know? Yeah. Can you say, you know, I'm being semi-serious here. Reputation is so important. Collaboration is so important. And what these students are going to learn is that if they don't treat you with courtesy, they may not be treated with courtesy down the line. That it's very much a way that we all want to be teaching our students a sense of professional ethics.
In a case like this, they're going to have to put a method section where the database was generated. Mm-hmm. As a reviewer of an article, if they didn't tell me how the original data was generated, it'd be rejected. Yep. So I don't think they have an option.
Thanks. That's
a good point.
And in terms of if you are getting permission, who you get, and this is an instance where you don't need permission your hypothetical, they didn't need permission, although oddly they got permission but aren't providing the attribution that was a condition of the permission. We don't know who, and that's what Vicky described as figuring out who has the copyright can be very difficult. It may be the researchers, it might be their university, it may be the publisher, and it's all annoyingly fact-specific. Mm-hmm. Any other questions about this hypothetical?
We've been talking about data a little bit. I wonder if you would mind if we jumped around a little, and I know there are some questions on things like reusing PowerPoint slides, and so maybe we'll talk about that for a little bit. There was the question brought up earlier about how do we go about giving permission or getting permission to use full or partial presentations? And I think that happens across extension and in classroom instruction as well. Anybody have any other specific experiences with this that you'd like to voice? And we that can start off our discussion here.
We had some fun because we started up a database for sharing presentations among extension faculty. We soon discovered that we not only had to worry about the slides themselves, but every single image that was used anywhere in the presentation, and it gets to be a lot of fun reviewing all those, making sure everyone said everything properly, or potentially putting it off on the original author that it was their responsibility upon upload for that to all be there. So it's been exciting to try to play with that. Have there been other things people have run into in presentations for what they're concerned about sharing?
Do I take that actually combines two of our case studies?
That's right.
You'll notice that this is a PowerPoint without images. partly there is a reason, but there are certainly folks who make a decent living out of licensing their Dilbert strips for PowerPoint presentations. The key, very often, the use of images is going to be fair use. I spend a whole lot of time, and my staff spends a lot of time clearing images for use in presentations and especially in social media. And most of the time, we don't get permission for two reasons. It's much. One of them is going to be fair use, and that's it. If the image is something you're really talking about, if you've got a PowerPoint about tomatoes and you want to show, or about bees and you want to show what the bee's body is, or you want to show what a particular type of tomato deformity is, you need an image for that. And that's something where it's going to be very useful. If you're putting in a pretty seed catalog copy, picture from that's under copyright from the 1980s, just because it'll make you want to make your presentation a little bit more interesting, that's less likely to be fair use. So you want to look at whether or not the image is really essential to the point that you're trying to make, or it's just there for illustration to make it more interesting. And so I think I'm at least try to get my people trained to really talk about something, and then I'm more likely to say yes, that's absolutely going to be fair use. And this doesn't go to presentations, but there is a general rule that if the image is small enough, and the technical term is thumbnail, we will approve. The courts have been pretty clear that a thumbnail is going to be fine. We have something called shelfies. If you're showing an array of books, an array of seed catalogs or seed packets, then it's not a substitute in the same way. And so that's something else that's likely to be we're going to hold to be fair use. And when I talked about there are a lot of things out there that are, if you want to use your illustration, that are in the public domain. Even Getty and Getty Images, which can be very, very aggressive as a copyright holder. It's a stock photo agency, and Getty has given very generous rights to millions of stock photo images to be used online, and that's one place to look. You can look for things that are Creative Commons licensed. You can look at there's a part of Flickr called the Flickr Commons, which includes a lot of government images and a lot of museum images that have been put into the public domain. So you can always look for things that are in the public domain, but images can be a little bit tricky. Whether or not you can blame the person who originally wrote the slides is another issue altogether. Do we have number six up there? Is that the case? Okay. So case study six is exactly where we started. You're loaning out your PowerPoint, or you're bringing it. You're putting it in a repository for others to use. More power to you. That's how many times do we all keep reinventing the same PowerPoints? Let's share it. Let's share this. We can do it. We can share our knowledge. When I talk about risk assessment, there's risk assessment in getting sued, but there's also risk assessment in not furthering our missions. And if the mission of an extension service is to get information out there, then sharing our knowledge, including our time is limited, and let's not spend it rewriting the same PowerPoints if we can give each other permission to use them. And that's a whole nother risk of and benefit of that kind of efficiency. But what you need to do when you're setting up that common repository is coming up with some rules. Just when you submit, say, I have permission. I have the right to submit this. so that that does give you that protection that whoever is submitting it has the right, not A, has the right to submit it, and B, is giving you the right to do this kind of work with it. So you can say, I am licensing this, I'm going to license this. You can use a CC license, a Creative Commons license. I'm licensing this for use for education, for educational purposes by other extension services.
I would back that up by saying, if we start setting a habit of getting permission and giving permission clearly, it's going to get a lot easier for everybody to know where everybody stands. You know, we kind of got ahead of ourselves with, just because we could photocopy something didn't mean we had the right to. Just because we can now download it and send it to all of our best friends doesn't mean that we have the right to. So we're just catching up with, where's the balance there with, you know, what's good for society and what's really unfair to the person who's depending on that object for a revenue stream. You know, that they put their effort into it, they should get something back for it.
At the same time, it is also all about relationships. I give you my PowerPoint. I may need your PowerPoint next week.
So isn't there's fair use in educational purposes? So if I remember correctly, I might not be right about this, that I can utilize a photo like once if I'm giving a PowerPoint presentation to a Master Gardener group or to a class. But then if I take that PowerPoint and I give it to Emily, and she uses it for something else, that's now not being used once, this could be used like multiple times. So the first time the first time I use it, it's fair use for educational purposes, but then if I perpetuate this image in a PowerPoint that I send out to all the master gardeners in the state of Minnesota, whatever, then that's no longer fair use, because I haven't gotten permission to use it multiple times.
Maybe. because it may still be fair use. If it is a picture of that blighted tomato and there isn't another if there isn't another appropriate substitute picture, then what you've described actually goes to the question of risk. There is zip risk sitting in front of a class of master gardeners face to face. Nobody cares. If I were to take that same PowerPoint and start and publish it, best practices for master gardeners or whatever, your risk goes way up, and you're more and it's also less likely to be fair use. So you start looking at that. But there's that interim of, I want to take my PowerPoint and I'm going to put it in the repository for other master gardeners in Minnesota. That's going to be somewhere in the middle of that continuum. And you start looking at, did you provide appropriate credit? I know, so where you got the picture of the tomato blight from? Do you have other alternatives? Are you making money off of it, or is it a purely educational use? Is this something that is from a book on tomato blight, so that this is their major market? Are you swiping this slide from somebody that's an educational program itself that is now, so that you're biting into their market? So again, maybe, and you need to look at all of those facts. I'm sorry, we don't have anything clear here.
Can I
Yeah.
So how about if it's just within? So I'm a University of Minnesota. And so what happens if it's like within the University of Minnesota Extension? We've had instances where we have borrowed each other's photographs, not given attribution because we all get kind of lazy. Maybe everyone else doesn't. But I pull these off kind of at the last minute and think, oh yeah, right, I should have bought the website and I didn't do it. And somebody asked me for the slides and I just hand them over. And so we had an issue where someone wasn't given attribution for their picture within the organization, but they were kind of paid to take these pictures. So it wasn't, it, they didn't have the copyright kind of, because they were getting, how do I describe it? They were getting paid
as part of their job,
To take these pictures. So the assumption was that it was kind of University of Minnesota's copyright, and so anybody in the university, yes, we should have given them attribution, which we didn't. That would have been moot. But is it okay for them to then come back and say, you can never ever use any of my pictures ever again, they are mine, and that's it? So it got a little messy within the university. Does that make sense?
It's all about people. It's all about relationships. I thought you people were supposed to be nice in Minnesota.
Yeah. Not what you think.
But no, I'm sorry. I'm being silly here now. You've described a situation that sounds like someone was peeved. They may or may not have had the legal right to be peeved. They may or may not, if the university hired them to do this, to create this library of images or this body of images for use within the university, they probably didn't have a legal right. But their feelings are hurt. Mm-hmm. And then that's the point where you just buy them a beer and say, I'm really sorry, it won't happen again.
It sounds to me too like we all within our organizations need to come up with just some kind of a contract, something that describes how it's supposed to work, how we all agree to share these images or share these presentations, and that way it's not a surprise to anyone. And does anyone have a system like that they work within that is working pretty well? Was it the system that you described when you first asked the question?
Yeah, you're doing one for presentation, one for videos, one for images, one for resources. It all kind of, because each one has some metadata to go with it. We think it's going well. We've been doing it for 24 years. But I am perpetually amazed at people's misconceptions about what they can and cannot do. And
like with the presentation?
Well, using a picture.
Okay.
And thinking of all that number in the corner, that's the citation. No, it's not. It says it clearly all over the site. Here is how you're supposed to do it. If we have that miscommunication or that misunderstanding with the people using the pictures, I'm almost afraid to ask our photographers what they thought they were doing when they were submitting pictures. And so what level do I need to, on the page it said this, so I covered my rear, I guess, but do I have to go to the point of having written permission forms in a digital world for every single person who ever gives me a piece of content? It's, we do a lot of risk analysis of, so how much trouble are we going to be in if this were to come back to bite us?
Well, I think it does get back to having an agency, an organizational, a departmental policy written down somewhere. You know, it may not protect you 100% against 100% of the stuff that's out there, but if everybody knows how you function, how you operate, and a group of reasonable-minded people would interpret it the same way, that will go a long way toward defending you against complaints or, worst-case, lawsuits. But if it's just what everybody feels like on any given Tuesday, your risk is way up there on you were feeling benevolent one day and somebody else wasn't. Mm-hmm. Communication and documentation really help.
Go ahead.
A question related to the use of extension publications. Say you get an image that you have fair use to as a non-a pulse. You're providing a database for use by other extension people. We're in an era of cost recovery. Our folks want you to charge for everything. Does that then change what is fair use if we're now charging a fee for a booklet, for a PowerPoint, or whatever?
It becomes part of the calculus, but not necessarily. I mean, one of the used to be that fourth factor was the most important factor, that the fourth factor of fair use is the market value. And then there was a Supreme Court case, which has absolutely nothing to do with horticultural science, involved two live crew. Two live crew made a great deal of money doing a sample of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. It was a satirical version of it, and very different from the original. They had sought a license. Orbison's estate said, "I don't want any this music used. I don't want it used for this purpose. I don't want this lovely little love song turned into a rap parody." Supreme Court said. Ruled for Two Live Crew, basically saying that this was in fact transformational, despite the fact that Two Live Crew made a whole lot of money on it, because of the way in which they were commenting and satirizing the original, and the idea that they didn't take any more of it than they had to. Sorry, long and legalistic answer to a short question. It's not the only factor, but it is a factor. You're still not making huge amounts of money out of it, and if your use is still transformational, then your use is the amount you use is reasonable, and the image or the text that you're using is on the fact side of the spectrum, it's still probably going to be fair use, unless somebody's undies get in a bunch and they decide to sue you. And then you talk to university council.
I'd like you to address the first doctrine of prayer, which is do I want the presentation to go to university? The reason I'm interested is in the early years of us getting our loan grant back, the university used a ridiculous amount of my photographs, didn't give me any kind of publication, nothing about it, and in some cases actually gave other people the attribute for it. So I'd really like to know. The other part of this also is I work with several other women in the state. We've done presentations. We have found other ag service providers, including our own extension people, taking the presentations. We no longer get the presentations out as a PowerPoint. It goes out as a PDF with more on a page so they can't digitize, or they can't just pull it off the page and make it a PowerPoint again, which I'm very displeased with. So it's probably going back to training staff, but the question, do I own it or does the university? Big question.
That we have no answer to. Because it depends, and different universities have different rules. Faculty tend to be in a better position than employees. There's something called a work made for hire. And a lot of times, if you have a photographer who's on staff, they probably staff photographers probably it's going to be a work made for hire. Yep. Yep. And that's a question of that goes back to acting like human beings, and sticking up for yourself and protecting yourself. You've basically sounds like what you've described with your PowerPoints is a form of very basic technological protection. I'm just not going to give it out anymore.
Bingo.
And that is a loss to everybody. That is a loss to the people who are trying to who could have used your information with permission and by giving you that appropriate level of credit, and instead are spending in this instance probably the taxpayer funds to recreate it. Well, I'm saying to recreate a different version of the same thing, because again, facts are not copyrightable, so they're remaking their own.
Yeah, question up front.
noticed over the years that at the University of Wisconsin, PhD theses, master's theses, the students always put copyright on their name. What does that mean? As a major professor, I had a major investment in the editing and writing of that thesis. Does that give them any rights? And to my knowledge, all they're doing is they're just sticking that at the bottom of the thesis.
Right. It doesn't particularly give them any rights, and most of the time, almost all universities are requiring the theses to be at least PhD theses and mostly master's theses be deposited, usually with a commercial service like ProQuest, but almost always with the university. But right now there's an issue right now with universities now saying we want to go back and digitize the last 50 years of theses, and do we have the right to do that? How much of the work is the students? How much to the degree that you've acted as their advisor, does it rise to the level of for copyright what's called a joint work, where you work on something with someone with the expectation that they be merged into a single product, so that it's not like a magazine where there are a number of separate articles, but it's a single product.
I'd also say that I've been at conferences where it was actually advised that you stick that little C on there just to kind of stake your territory. You may not actually have the copyright, but better to have put that there and tried to claim it and have somebody shoot you down later than to leave it ambiguous. So I think they were probably taking that to the extreme of, until somebody tells me it's not my copyright, I'm going to claim my copyright.
But since 1989, it has not been legally required, and it doesn't give you a whole lot of protection. Yes. Man with the mic first, or then you guys work it out.
I'm still trying to understand. Back to my first question, in response to what he said, he told me, I heard you say a minute ago that anything I write is copyright.
Anything you write is copyrighted. That's what I'm saying. The adding the symbol to it is not required and doesn't give you any particular protection.
Is your question?
You're saying they wrote their own thesis.
His question to mean that the student thought they were copyrighting it by adding the city on
it. Yeah, it gives them no additional protection.
They're already protected.
It's already protected, yeah.
Thank you.
Unless they were doing this prior to 1989 when they had to do that.
Question. I have a question about citation. We have a newsletter for vegetable growers, and our growers are very interested in knowing the weather information in our state. And we had a website, we created very nice, like the temperatures in the past week, created very nice pictures. And we share that in their website. It's open access, everyone can see it. If we put that pictures in our newsletter to give them to our visitors, and in the pictures they created, they already have their name of their organizations, their website, all is in that picture. So if we use those pictures, we'll be automatically on that picture.
That's a little bit shaky. You can certainly make an argument that that's fair use if there's the argument is that if it's something that's not weather.com, it's not a commercial service. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's also not you'd be much safer using a NOAA map or a weather map that's produced by the government that you may actually have the right to use, but that image is it really depends on where the image came from and again what you're using it for. It sounds like you're using it to provide information, but when you talk about it as an image rather than reproducing a factual table, you're setting off the little flashy warning lights of because if I'm taking somebody else's image of a sunrise to show that it's a lovely day in July, wouldn't work for today. Then there may in fact be a copyright image that is not that's starting to sound like pretty picture rather than conveying information, and that sets off my little warning bells for fair use. But on the other hand, if your newsletter goes to 200 people and is handed out and it's not digital, it's probably low risk. Is there a reason you can't use the link? Yeah, because if you send them back to the source, if you're sending them back to the source, they're getting superior data because they're getting the up to date information, and you're serving your community better without that risk.
Good, thanks. Any other questions? We have about 5 minutes left. Really, any questions that you have about any of these topics? Yes.
Maybe this is a weird one, but I don't know whether to be upset or flattered when someone cuts and pastes my insect pest distribution map into their company newsletters. I'm kind of flattered, actually. They're not worth anything. Sometimes, I mean, they realize I'm doing it, but I feel like I get adequate credit in other ways. So I'm torn about whether, okay. And there's no teeth in it anyways. I mean, what am I going to do about it? If somebody cuts and pastes and reuses it, and they only show it within their organization. Is this something you notify your university about, or?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, that's.
What was the recommendation?
Ask for a donation.
There you go, or maybe a link on the under the image back to the original source.
Well, that was the one thing. The only thing is, we started putting our logos on the images, because we noticed they were going to use. We wanted them to know the source. We didn't want them to think they just popped out.
And then there's cropping that anybody can do to crop that out if they want to.
Is it wrong to crop those little numbers in bugwood.org images?
No.
Okay. Well, that's what I was
legal. There is a provision of copyright law that makes it it's a separate copyright violation. Vicki had mentioned the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and removing metadata is in fact arguably about. Well, if they're cropping it off, they're removing it.
Okay.
But I think but as a practical matter, you know, if you're really annoyed, you write them a letter, or you have your university council write them a letter saying cut it out, it's called a cease and desist letter. Or you can establish the particular requirements, like I want attribution, or I want a donation, and really stop. Just tell them to stop, because they know they have made in republishing that, they have made their risk assessment, and you have to tell them that their risk assessment their judgment was off.
I'm confused with the direction that's going, because what I'm talking about is an image that has a number. 135671.
Oh, I'm answering an earlier question. I'm sorry. I'm back to answering your original question of these people are taking my work, and should I be flattered or annoyed? And the answer is yes.
Okay. So if I crop 135161, but I do say this photo was provided courtesy of Gerald Simmons at bugwood.org and cite it the way that they asked it to be cited. That's okay?
That should be okay, yeah.
And I think there's someone behind you that can answer that, right?
I am bugwood. So, yeah, you can. We explicitly on our image use
picture. Mm-hmm. We put it all over everything, and it's not an uncommon question. So you are welcome to reuse as long as you cite the photographer as indicated. All the photographers have agreed to that.
And I think we have time for one more question.
Now, I think this is a good concluding question. Based on what we talk about here, everybody obviously share information online. And right now, we're all using digital footprints to identify information, who said what, who shared what. We all share a lot of things. We all have all kinds of digital footprints out there. Now, the question is, when we get out there to do data sourcing, data mining process, we don't know who shared what, because this and that, they were saying these things. We don't even know where those things came from. So how do we handle that situation for risk assessment? Your answer will help me big time, because I'm putting a proposal together. I need this language. Thank you very much.
And I would bounce it to the gentleman in the plaid shirt who says he's doing he's reviewing research methodology and just determining whether or not to publish. And the idea is you need to be transparent about what your research methodology is and what those sources were. And let's see what your answer is.
Well, my comment was, as a solicited reviewer of manuscripts, if the editor sent me this paper and there was this data that magically appeared that was analyzed by the students, they wouldn't have described their methodology, so the paper would get rejected. And so if you're using something that doesn't magically appear in any peer-reviewed journal, that's going to be a problem. Now, in a proposal, having reviewed some of those as well, usually in an area where I know a great deal, if you're just plagiarizing something and not telling where it came from, you encounter the same problems. You're not creating something new. So when the system works entirely, it's self-correcting.
Great. Well, thank you for that. We are at the end of our time. I would like to thank Hope O'Keefe and Vicki Crone for helping us out with some of these issues today. I appreciate also your input and your questions. I encourage you to join the Intellectual Property Rights Group on the ASHS website. We are trying more and more to keep these kinds of conversations going and make a place where we can discuss this, because obviously there's no one answer to any of these questions. And it's all about communication and understanding the expectations of people that own intellectual property and those who want to use it. So I encourage you to join the group, and we'll keep this conversation going. We are having our business meeting directly after this session right here in this room. So if you're not a member and you're interested, please stick around and we'll talk a bit about the things that we have in mind to do in the coming year. And thank you so much for coming.